This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We just have to recognize reality. A democracy will not be able to engage with corrupt countries as fully as another corrupt country can. And that is a Russian advantage. We have to find innovative ways to work around that.
That was David DeRoche, associate professor at the National Defense University, on the challenges for the West in competing with Russia and China for influence in Africa. Details coming up also. The U.S. Congress is considering legislation to ban the popular video app TikTok. And South African police say kidnappings have quadrupled over the past decade. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill yesterday that would lead to a nationwide ban of the popular video app TikTok if its China-based owner does not sell, amid concerns that the company's ownership structure is a national security threat. VOA's Paulin Diho joins us live in the studio to talk about the proposal. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Paul.
Thank you, Yahes, for having me.
So, for the purpose of our audience, define TikTok first and talk to us about this, the U.S. House of Representatives bill moving forward.
Thank you, Yahes. First of all, TikTok is one of the most popular video apps that is out there. It has about 2 billion daily users. So, it's a platform where a lot of young people go to sell products, to produce content. So people use it for a wide range of reasons. But perhaps more importantly, why is this a topic in Washington? Washington thinks that TikTok has the potential to be used by the Chinese government as a spying agent because they cannot control the algorithm used by TikTok. So they want control. They are forcing, they want to force the parent company of TikTok, ByteDance, to sell TikTok to an investor here in the United States.
So are you saying lawmakers in the U.S. are arguing that the Chinese government could use TikTok to spy on Americans?
Absolutely. There are those concerns, and I think those concerns are valid. When you think about it, China has had this going for a very long time. They keep a tab on every single individual in China. So, and any company associated with China has, by law, they have a law that the intelligence networks there can compel that company to provide them data. So that's why legislators here in the United States are concerned about the use of TikTok in the United States, and people using these apps to do all sorts of things, because it can track your movement, it can track everything that you do. And based on that, it sends you, like, let's say, what you like, your favorite stuff that you watch all the time. It will keep sending you stuff. So the fact that they can do that, that's why there's a lot of concern that China could use this to spy on Americans.
So far, I mean, like you mentioned earlier, it's young people are involved with this TikTok, most of them. How are they reacting to this news?
Great question, Yahes. I think this is one of the most important issues of our time. As a young person, or as I've seen people react to this, it's really not a good place. You have a lot of young people, especially 12-year-olds to 30. This is their platform. You have about 170 million Americans on TikTok. These are people who use the platform for almost everything you can think about, whether it's producing content, whether it's selling products on the internet. You have a lot of them who do all sorts of things there. And TikTok has opened up so many doors for them. TikTok has become a business platform for these young people. People are using, shockingly, I saw a Biden ad. President Joe Biden ad on TikTok. So I'm surprised that even the legislators are talking about banning TikTok in the United States.
There seems to be a generational gap here. The representatives, the U.S. representatives, their age, and what they are doing to the young people. There seems to be a disconnect here.
You make a great point. People who think that the legislators are reacting or are legislating in fear. And most of them are really oblivious to what TikTok can do. Most of them are not on TikTok. So that's also a challenge when you have 170 million Americans, especially young people, on TikTok, and the people making the laws are maybe average age 60 and above, you know? So there's that disconnect.
VOA's Paul Andijo, thank you for your input.
A pleasure being here. Thank you.
The global ripple effects of Russia's invasion of Ukraine have hit hard in already struggling African economies. Many rely on Russia and Ukraine for critical imports such as wheat, fertilizers, and steel. However, Russian oil exports to Africa in 2023 skyrocketed to 14 times per invasion levels as the country's producers sought ways around international sanctions, attempting to limit its oil sales. David DeRoche, associate professor at the National Defense University, discussed Russian economic maneuvers in Africa with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Yeah, this is one of the great tragedies of the Russian aggression against Ukraine. Both Ukraine and Russia were large, low-cost exporters of wheat and of fertilizer. And, I said at the outset of the invasion that the guys who are really going to pay for this are mostly in Africa. It's poor countries that don't have the purchasing power to substitute low-cost Ukrainian and Russian fertilizer and wheat with more higher cost imports from Australia or Canada or elsewhere. Unfortunately, that's gone on. What these countries have done to adapt is to violate Russian sanctions and purchase Russian fuel at a discount. I think that will go on for the foreseeable future. And I think that the sanctions regime is not as steadily enforced on this because, first off, because there is a lot of need for fuel in these countries. And secondly, because Russia is forced to sell it as a discount. So that's seen as damaging them. But in the long term, if this war goes on for a long time, and I think that any peace in Ukraine will really just be a ceasefire while Russia seeks to recapitalize its lost military, unless, there is regime change in Russia. I think that again, this has to be addressed. And the fact that you just have profoundly poor countries who don't have the ability to pay competitive rates for fuel and basic foodstuffs if a major producer goes offline, that's going to continue to be a problem.
Some analysts say that Moscow's increasing ambitions to position itself as an ally to African countries and stoke anti-Western sentiment could turn the continent into a flashpoint in the global strategic competition between Russia and the West. They warn that Russia's support of authoritarian governments, including its backing of a string of coups in recent years, is undermining Africa's democratic aspirations. Your thoughts?
Democracy has always been more of an aspiration than a fact in Africa. Even where you have democratic systems, they quickly tend to move into a democratic facade over a tribal system, or they tend to be subverted by corrupt rulers. And that's the real tragedy of Africa, is the potential's never been realized because in most of the continent, the leadership has just been bad. Russia is playing up to the worst aspects of Africa. And in the long term, this always works against the aspirations of the peoples of Africa. I suppose a cynic would say that the West deals with Africa as they want it to be. Russia deals with Africa as it is. In large part, that's because it's just very hard in a Western democracy to say, yeah, we're going to, deal with corrupt leaders in a way they want to, which involves a lot of money being siphoned off. But, you know, at the end of the day, we just have to recognize reality. A democracy will not be able to engage with corrupt countries as fully as another corrupt country can. And that is a Russian advantage. We have to find innovative ways to work around that, because the Russians and the Chinese don't really care who they deal with as long as their interests are addressed. Western democracies, on the other hand, have to be a little bit more selective. And that's a disadvantage, a handicap we've taken upon ourselves. And it's something that we have to find a way to work through.
That was David DeRoche, associate professor at the National Defense University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Landlocked Ethiopia signed an agreement with Somaliland in January that would make it the first nation to recognize the sovereignty of the semi-autonomous region of Somalia in return for 50 years of access to the Gulf of Aden. The accord triggered a diplomatic uproar, with Somalia saying it would defend its territorial integrity and Egypt and other nations urging caution. Now, with Kenya mediating, Ethiopia is considering scrapping the plan. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, tells me the dispute does not need to escalate. He says it's primarily about economics and points out that Ethiopia, Somalia, Kenya, and Somaliland have a lot of shared interests.
I think what we're seeing in this dispute are two long-running strategic issues for the region, namely Ethiopia's economic growth and need for port access, and then secondly, you know, the de facto autonomy of Somaliland and how the rest of the region and the world relate to it. So I see those two independent issues coming together with this negotiation to set up port access for Ethiopia out of the Port of Berbera, which responds to the interest of both Somaliland and Ethiopia, these long-running interests.
Let's go back to the genesis of the dispute. Was Ethiopia right to actually sign a memorandum of understanding with Somaliland, but Somalia views the memorandum of understanding as a breach of its territorial integrity?
I think if we look at it analytically, that Ethiopia has pressing economic interest as the largest and most dynamic economy in the Horn of Africa. And so it has understandable interest in retaining reliable port access. Currently, 90% of Ethiopian exports go through the Port of Djibouti, which is not its most direct route. And so a discussion about port access to Berbera is a very logical economic type of decision. Now, the question is whether Ethiopia could have approached this differently and engaged Somalia, the government of Somalia, and alerted them to its interest and tried to proactively alleviate any concerns and tensions that there might be with a potential economic arrangement to use the port of Berbera. But as I said, the government of Somalia not come to terms with the de facto autonomy of Somaliland. And so there's an issue there that needs to be resolved, and it's been around for quite a long time.
So, Mr. Siegel, amid this backdrop, Kenya, under the leadership of President William Ruto, has embarked on a delicate mission to ease tensions and promote dialogue. You think that is a very prudent and good move by Kenya?
I think it is a very timely move, and it's a demonstration of much-needed leadership. I have an independent third party that borders both Ethiopia and Somalia to bring the leaders together and try to forge an understanding here. You know, this dispute does not need to escalate. Really, this is about economics primarily. There are a lot of shared interests here between Ethiopia, Somalia, Kenya. Kenya and Ethiopia have been strong supporters of Somalia in its fight against Al-Shabaab.
So Kenya not only serves to de-escalate the immediate tensions between Ethiopia and Somalia, but also positions Kenya as a mediator and stabilizer in the region. What is Somaliland's role in this geopolitical puzzle?
Well, you know, Somaliland has, again, asserted its independence since 1991. And, you know, without any international recognition, Somaliland has really overachieved in terms of maintaining security, developing its economy, making itself business-friendly, helping to develop its port, which has received international investment from the UAE and others. And it's a significant exporter for the size of its economy and the size of its population. Moreover, it has really advanced democratic practices. There isn't anybody who would say Somaliland is a full democracy at this point, but there's certainly a high degree of political participation. They've had a succession of leaders. They've had credible elections. And so it's been acting very much like an independent state.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with me here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. In South Africa, police say kidnappings have quadrupled over the past decade, sparking fear in a nation already plagued by violent crime. Darren Taylor reports.
A police report says an average of 51 people are now being kidnapped every day in South Africa. Victims are held until their families pay money or they're trafficked to other provinces or countries. The latest police crime statistics reflect criminals kidnapped almost 4,600 people in the final 3 months of 2023. Lizette Lancaster, a crime expert at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, tells VOA the number of kidnappings is likely much higher because many people don't report cases as they're afraid the kidnappers will harm their loved ones. Police Minister Becky Cele tells VOA syndicates are mainly targeting wealthy business people. Gangs specializing in human trafficking also kidnap students and children. He says kidnappers often wear police uniforms and demand ransoms of several million rands. Lancaster says the perpetrators are highly organized.
People that are able to plan very effectively, that have the resources, and I think this is what is so fascinating, if it wasn't so alarming. They have the resources to kidnap this person, often the numbers. They also have the safe houses, and they have the means to communicate fairly professionally with the family, and then the means to either ask for cash or through other traditional money transfers or even crypto transfers.
Lancaster says the gangs plan and carry out kidnappings with military precision. This leads her to suspect that they've previously committed other crimes, especially cash-in-transit armed robberies, but are now kidnapping people because it's less risky for them.
It might also be international groups or regional groups. So you have this mix of people targeting people that are often in business, fairly vulnerable in their shops. You won't see these necessarily as much in high security areas or, you know, malls in Sandton, for example. You'll see it in sort of street-facing shops, often of people that trade in cash.
Lancaster says the police specialized kidnapping task force is doing an excellent job, but he's overwhelmed by the sheer numbers of crimes. Private investigator Herman Bosman says he too is swamped with kidnapping cases, especially of children.
We're currently looking at one incident for every half an hour. We had 8 a day in 2010. We're now looking at the last quarter where we looked at 50 per day. That is something that needs to sound alarms. And we need a priority committee to address this. It cannot be that...
According to Bosman's research, organized crime groups abduct people more in South Africa because it's the most affluent economy on the continent.
Definitely, South Africa is fast becoming the place where kidnappings are taking the lead. We should not go into a phase where we say, well, this is the new normal. We are very quickly at a place where we would be labeled as the kidnapping country. And we cannot afford that. We want investors and we want our economy to grow.
Bosman says there are kidnapping hotspots across Africa, such as Nigeria. Militant organizations in Nigeria have carried out several high-profile mass kidnappings, including several this year. Media reports in Nigeria say nearly 4,000 people were kidnapped in that country last year. That compares with more than 14,000 last year in South Africa. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The U.S. Space Telescope Science Institute has a new boss, 49-year-old Dr. Jennifer Lotz. As part of our coverage of Women's History Month, VOA's Carol Van Dam asked Jennifer Lotz how she got her start.
As a little girl, I was very interested in astronomy and science in general. When I was a kid with my dad, we watched the Cosmos series with Carl Sagan on TV. I grew up in rural Pennsylvania where the night skies are pretty dark, and I would go out in the backyard and watch for shooting stars. And then when I went to college, I was trying to decide whether I wanted to study physics and astronomy or writing. And I thought, well, I could write without having a physics degree, but I couldn't do physics and astronomy without a physics and astronomy degree. And I've been very fortunate to have a lot of excellent mentors and teachers along the way. So I have a PhD in astrophysics that I got from Johns Hopkins University. I was a researcher for many years, and the last 5 or 6 years I've made the transition to leadership because I wanted to have a bigger impact on science and astronomy than I could do as an individual researcher.
What do you feel are some of the most important achievements that you've been able to oversee?
Well, I've just been in this particular role for about 4 weeks, so the achievements for those teams, I think most other people get credit for that. You know, the team here is fantastic. Getting that very complicated telescope instrument, having it just work so well. I remember watching videos of all the little pieces that needed to come out, right? Like the solar array and unfolding of the mirrors. And there were a lot of places where something could have gone wrong, very wrong, and it just went beautifully. And astronomers around the world are so excited. Like we just finished the third round of selecting the proposals for the things that will be observed with the James Webb Space Telescope. And for every program that we're able to accept, there are 8 programs that we had to reject. So there's a 9-to-1 ratio of demand versus supply for time on this telescope.
You know, and speaking of those, I guess, experiments and other programs that people put in for and they want to be selected in connection with the Webb Space Telescope, not that long ago, people could get in because kind of on virtue of who they knew and, you know, connections mm-hmm. that they used. And now it's a totally blind kind of programming thing and more women are getting in. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that is something that when I was a staff member here, I helped facilitate, but the Space Telescope Science Institute really led the way in trying to make the evaluation process much fairer by essentially taking the names off of all of the proposals when they're reviewed and actually making sure that the language in the proposals don't say, oh, our paper from 2010 was great, right? And that is a practice that is now adopted across the science world.
That's Dr. Jennifer Lotz, director of the Space Telescope Science Institute. She was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam from Baltimore, Maryland. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.